This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman, and this morning for Catherine Cruz. Homelessness is an issue of concern on every island, but it may be most visible on Oahu. Government's been making some strides to help the homeless at both the state and county levels, but the needs are great, and the path to success stories usually not a straight line. It's a situation that's not just about that big picture. It's a story of individuals as well. HPR's Noe Tanigao has been spending some time in Honolulu's Kaka'ako neighborhood and joins us this morning with one person's story.
Hi, Bill. I am so happy, really, to be able to bring Aura Reyes' story, particularly to you here. I'd like to introduce her. Aura Reyes, I'd say she's in her early 40s, brown hair, medium built. She's one of the principals in a group that's starting up there in Kaka'ako called Kapo'e'o Kaka'ako. And it's a group that's trying to form a community solution to the homeless that are dotting that Kaka'ako area. So I met Aura at a park cleanup that Kapo'e was sponsoring. They've been going to the neighborhood boards and talking to some of the area businesses and so on. We sat under a tree, Bill, and she opened up a whole side of Honolulu that I've been so curious about. How is this living done on the streets? Aura is a certified nurse's aide. She worked for TSA at the time she became homeless. She said she just doesn't know why. She was always a paycheck behind in her payments, you know. Her husband was minding the kids. They've got four. One with special needs. And finally, they went for some social service counseling.
The services they offered to me, I was like, oh, my God, we could so use a psych evaluation. Oh, my goodness, we could so use that for our kids. Like, they need, no, our son needs to get into that kind of program. Like, hey, and if they can expedite them getting into it and us getting what we need, sure, I'm game. I'm down for it. That messed me up. So now we're promised all these wonderful services.
Yeah.
But now our, I don't know, it just felt like they were there to just break us up.
That was her perception. The family was really stretched thin at that time. The oldest was about 13 years old, was starting to act up in school. They had school conferences. They had separate activities for all the kids after school. One of the kids was still a baby under the age of one. Aura still had her two jobs, CNA and TSA. And they now also had those mandatory counseling appointments. And then the rent went up.
$400 was the jump. To renew the lease would be to $1,500. I cannot do that.
I said, oh my God. And then, you know, before I actually became homeless, I called all these places up. And they're like, sorry, we can only help you if you're homeless. I said, oh my God, what if I'm trying not to be homeless? Like, really, really? I have to lose everything before you can help me? Like, are you serious? No, I don't want to be homeless. Like, can I help me now? No, yes. The day after I became homeless, I said, where the hell were all those places that said that they would help me?
Where were they?
I couldn't find it. I was like, what the heck? I write everything. I lost everything. I don't have nothing. So I'm starting all over with no phone because my phone got stolen. Like, no phone, no money, no Wi-Fi, no food, no nothing, zero. You start your day with zero.
What do you make of that, Bill?
You know, the two points. I would say one, that fragility of existence, of the idea of being a paycheck away from slipping, but also that idea that for people on the edge of that there's not as much of an emphasis in terms of being, or at least
just staying on that bottom rung.
Exactly, or at least support that she has been aware of, she and others. So I think part of that broader education about resources that may be available within the community is part of that.
I think I've been hearing about some programs that do help people right at that level, and I think that's one thing. What happened to them was, Family Promise Shelter took them in. They timed out of there. Then the children stayed in their mother-in-law's house while she and her husband slept in the park in the back. That fell apart. They moved to Lili'uokalani Park, then Dole Park. And still, Aura was working two jobs.
You're at the bottom of your bottom of your bottom. I'm still trying to go to work. You know what I mean? Like, go to work, show up at work, and make like nothing's wrong, and you're still... You don't want to tell people you're homeless, that you lost everything, that you couldn't cut it, you couldn't make the grade, you couldn't, you know what I mean? Like, was it my fault? But it just sounds like an excuse. It always sounds like an excuse. They all wanted to save my family money, you know, my friends. they're having the same struggle, most of them. They would have helped us, but now they got all their kids plus their kids' kids, and now their kids' kids are having kids all crammed up in a 3-4 bedroom house. Like, they're doing the best they can, trying to take care of 20 people in their house. It's hard.
Boy, Bill, talking to Aura, talking to the beaches and the Sandovals, the formerly homeless that I met on Maui, the slide down and out, you know what's happening. And
well, that attention to the idea, as you say, of folks hanging on to the last rung and before that last slip happens, I think there's another element of this that people may not be as broadly aware of, and that's the working homeless, folks who work jobs, people who are putting in efforts and trying to just, you know, give me another little boost up on this because I'm already doing this.
Or I am currently living in my car.
Mm-hmm.
Or well, I'm living in a storage space, showering at my gym.
There are, again, different levels to this in terms of that's the phrase that I used before about the fragility of existence in an environment where costs are fixed and high and unforgiving.
Oh, boy. And you know what? Talking to these people, Laura said it again. She said that the worst part of it is what happens when you become an outcast. People not being able or willing to look you in the eye.
It hurts. It already hurts to be here and then to be accused of things that you're not doing, or to try and follow the law only for them to make another law so that you're now breaking the law, or you know what I mean? Like, plenty of people out here are like, oh my God, I've never gotten a ticket before in my life until I came out here. Like,
imagine the people that come out here on their own.
It's hard.
If you had lost everything today and you had a backpack on your back, of course now you have your most, whatever is most important to you in your bag. You have to fall asleep someplace. And anytime you fall asleep, if you give them an opportunity, they will take it. So if we fall asleep, my bag is on me in my front.
I didn't realize, Bill, that being able to go to sleep, you're ultimately vulnerable. She slept with two jackets on, one forward, one backward, just to feel safe about that. There's just so many things we don't know about the life there. She said that we've used the word homeless throughout this story, and it's a word, Aura says, is just loaded with ugly stereotypes. She prefers the word houseless, but even then, you know, it's not the best. We don't really know. I mean, these are people, human, regular individuals that we're talking about.
Well, and in terms of the issues involved, I mean, it's broad, it's complicated, clearly, but also, again, the differences among people who are working, trying to work, doing, it's not just sort of a lifestyle choice. and that, again, makes a big difference in terms of a lot of people's lives.
And how people look at them. Next time, I'd like you to meet John Mantanona. He's another member of Kapo'e o Kaka'ako, and they're just pulling individuals together to create this kauhale-style community. Now, look at this word kauhale. Hawaiian, defined as a compound with a Hawaiian. It's that this compound comprised a Hawaiian home. It would be eating houses, sleeping houses. This is the kind of model of personal space and shared facilities that a community can work on, and that's what these people are thinking about. And we'll look at that idea with them.
Communities we can work on. Noe Tanigawa, thanks for being here, and we'll be back with more of this down the road, I'm sure.
Hey, thanks so much, Bill.
HPR Arts Culture Ideas reporter Noe Tanigawa. You can find her reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of America's first black sports hero, Major Taylor. He broke racial barriers by becoming the world's fastest and most famous cyclist at the height of the Jim Crow era. Our guest will be Washington Post investigative reporter Michael Cranish, author of a new book about Taylor called The World's Fastest Man. Join us.
Hear Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, right after On Point.
Hi, this is Jose Fajardo, president and general manager at Hawaii Public Radio. If HPR is a part of your daily routine, isn't it time to make a commitment and become a member of the station? New members are so important to helping HPR grow and give you more of the programs that you already know and love. So why not take 2 minutes and become a member today at $10 a month or any amount that works for you? Just go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Each new member really does help, and thanks.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of an architect, merchant, and painter who left his mark during the days of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Born in Hamburg, Germany, he settled in Hawaii by way of Australia in 1850. By 1852, he'd become a citizen of the Kingdom of Hawaii and made his living operating a small general store. He's a trained architect and carpenter. His work caught the eye of King Kamehameha IV, who commissioned him to design architecture in and around Honolulu. His first royal project was the design and construction of Queen's Medical Center. Kamehameha IV died a few years later, and another project presented itself. Our mystery architect was then given the job of building a royal mausoleum that would house departed members of the royal family. His final major project would be the construction of the Iolani Barracks, which still stand today, although in a different location on the palace grounds. In addition to his architecture, he also developed his craft as a painter, and his work can be seen hanging at the Hawaii State Art Museum. Now, for today's backyard quiz, who is this? What's his name? If you know, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells folks you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 15th Annual Hawaii Performing Arts Festival, presenting a season filled with concerts almost daily from June 24th through July 21st. Details at hawaiiperformingartsfestival.org.
Hawaii is, of course, a tourism economy. And, of course, that economy can't function without air travel. United Airlines has been flying to Hawaii for 7 decades. It's now the largest supplier of airline seats coming to Hawaii. Oscar Munoz is the CEO of United. He was recently in the islands meeting United employees and touring facilities and took some time to talk with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
So, Oscar, what's going on in the airline business these days?
Oh, nothing. It's just this normal, quiet summer. No, there's just so many things. In fact, I just returned from an international conference of all the CEOs of all the airlines in the world in South Korea, and Seoul was great enough to host us and covered a wide variety of issues, and from sustainability to cybersecurity to a lot of different regulatory issues that we face around the world. And so exciting time, a growing time for a lot of folks, and more importantly, an awareness of not only our community, but what growth can do in a negative way. So making sure that we do our part as an aviation industry to make sure that the world accepts us and continues to fly us in a wonderful way.
The airline business has traditionally been a pretty tough one to be successful in. Do you think it's getting easier or harder as the years go by?
You're right. Historically, it has been. I think over the last few years, at least in the domestic part of the world where we operate as United, we travel over the world, but our base business is in domestically. It has gotten, I wouldn't say easier, but it has allowed us to generate a little bit of return so that we can reinvest. And our reinvestment goes right back into the customer experience, and we do a lot of that across the system. So it's been nice to be able to be less worried about the fluctuations in the economy or in fuel, and so we have a little bit more financial stability that allows us to do that reinvestment. But we still have margins that are well below other businesses and industries, so we're constantly wary. And all of us that have watched this industry for a long time always remember those lean times. So we're always thoughtful to make sure we don't take our wonderful customers and the growing public that flies us, we don't take them for granted.
In the automobile industry right now, the big manufacturers are making huge investments in what they see as the aspects of the future for that business. What do you think is the future of the airline industry?
The autonomous vehicles is probably what you're referring to. I do not, in the near future, see the technology probably may happen with regards to drone-like flying. We have 12,000 pilots that I think are wonderful at what they do, and I, for one, would love to continue to fly with human beings in the front. And so I think the social acceptance of a human pilotless thing is a bit off. And so what we invest in, I mean, there's all sorts of amazing technology, fuel efficiency of our aircraft, takeoff and liftoff capability, liftoff in the sense that you can come in and out of shorter airports all over the world. So there's a lot of technology coming our way. We at United are really investing in what I would term relevant technology, relevant to you, the customer. So what makes your life less stressful? What makes your life easier as a customer? What makes it easier for our employees to give you service? So we've invested a lot in our app, a lot of digital things that we've been working, both directly with customers, what we call below the wing, out in maintenance to make sure our aircraft are always serviced properly. Also, there's a lot of really exciting things that is using AI and big data components, but at the same time with a human level of engagement and touch.
A lot of industries, there's a big push to go green, to find alternatives to traditional technologies that might pollute more. It seems to me that there isn't really a readily available substitute to fossil fuels for the airline industry. Do you think that jet fuel, as we know it now, is here to stay for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think in the near term, the mass quantities that are required for this industry would point to the fact that there's not going to be an immediate near-term sort of solution. But that shouldn't inhibit or prohibit us from making a play. And so United was the first in America to sort of put out an objective for us of a 50% reduction in fossil fuels by the year 2050, staying in, along with other accords. I think our path there is a combination of certainly more fuel-efficient aircraft, a lot of things we're doing on the ground to be more efficient, but the big piece has to be in alternative fuel supplies. We are one of the few investors in companies that are in that space. We continue to invest in that business for biofuels. We have flown some of the only few commercial sort of flights with biofuel. The issue, of course, is being able to make enough of it and at the right price. And so that's the investment we're making. And again, I think if you think of biofuel futures, we are probably the biggest investor in that space. Just because it's potentially far away doesn't mean you should take investment. I think Al Gore likes to say, you know, if you see a problem, which climate change is a problem, if you see a problem, can you do something about it? And of course, you can always do something about it. The real critical question is, will you do something about it? And I think the United family has made a very deep conviction to this space, and it's one that it's important for the future. And you see growing concern around this, around the world, not so much in the United States, but we're not doing it because there's growing concern. We do it because it's the right thing. So hopefully, as the rest of my brethren, both domestically and internationally, join us in that space, I think you'll see a lot more effort. And again, it was a big point of communication at this international conference.
Your company is a global one in a very literal sense. How important is a market like Hawaii to your business?
Oh, well, it's, you know, we've been flying here for seven decades. We are by far the largest supplier of seeds and capacity to this market. We have deep roots with the community, and so it's critically important to us. And it is, like anything in our business, it gets competitive, and you have people come and you have people go. And so we continue to offer the best service, the best schedules. One of the things that's critical, it's not just the flight. It's when the flight arrives, when the flight departs. For certain people, it's what type of aircraft it is. Do you have a lie flat seat? Because it's a long way to get here, especially from the East Coast in the United States. We also fly from Japan, from Guam, from Micronesia. And so we have a deep investment that lasts for a long period of time. We have, I think, 40 plus daily flights into these islands from various parts of the world. And importantly, when you get to the United States, if that's where you're going, we can connect you everywhere in the country. So it's a critical market for us. It's one we've been growing, and we started growing 2.5 years ago before a lot of other entrants came in. So it'll be competitive, but again, we've been here a long time. We know how to manage it.
How has the 737 MAX issue affected your company? We still have yet to see a resolution to that issue. How do you see it playing out going forward?
Well, the impact has been sizable for many. Our team has done an amazing job of trying to lessen the effect on customers. Obviously, with that aircraft not available to you, we had flights scheduled, so we've been trying to not cancel as much, use substitute aircraft. And so we're making all those, sort of moving around all those chess pieces, which does have some impact. In fact, we're here in Hawaii. We did have to take one of our flights down for a short period of time to let that aircraft take care of our customers domestically. So our team has been able to make those adjustments. I think what we've talked about with regards to its return to flight, the MAX, is it's important to let the regulators and the investigators do their thing. Of course, we would want it back as soon as possible. More importantly, we want it to come back with the stamp of approval, not just from the regulators, not from the manufacturer, but really we have to have public perception approve it, right? It's really important that we do that. So our team is busily working on a communications plan and a process, but I can guarantee you that we will be very transparent with what aircraft you're flying on. And if anybody has any concern at any point in time, we'll absolutely, readjust their schedule to make that as easy as possible. But again, we're going to wait for all the due process to happen, and we'll return it to flight for as soon as possible.
What kind of public feedback did you get when that issue first came about?
It's hard to say. There's always a few people who exhibited concern. But at the same time, a lot of people did not. And so now it's played out for a few months. There's been a lot of press and a lot of concern. I think the important part is we want to make sure that we err on the side of caution and the side of the customer's perception and view. If you feel it's not safe for some reason, we need to ameliorate that. And so we will continue to gauge and watch what folks do. But again, at the initial aspects, it was kind of a short burst, and we didn't see a lot of impact at that point in time. But that's not going to guide us as we bring it back to flight.
Has your company seen any impacts from the ongoing trade war between the United States and several other countries, either directly or indirectly?
Well, there's always indirect. I have a lot of conversations with senior leaders in all of these countries that we've been having social media conversations with, it doesn't create a warm feeling, certainly, but from the pure raw economics of business and business travel, China in particular would be the one that we're asked about. We really fly a lot of people there, and that there's been no discernible impact on our flying there. And that's not to say that over a longer term you may not see it, but we've not really seen any impact of any magnitude at this point.
Is the prospect of that divide between the United States and China worsening something that concerns you over the long run if there were to be a reduction in travel?
Yeah, and this isn't political, but I think the shared purpose of the United Family is to connect people and unite the world. Those are the actual physical words we use. The second part, unite the world, came from a lot of our 90,000 folks, and we take this very seriously, and the fact that we do connect the world. We are the largest global airline out of America, and we fly into many countries, and we value the diversity, the richness and tradition of thought of these many folks. And so as these these as governmental issues like this erupt, it does create a little bit of an impact. And we just hope that all of those things get worked out in the proper case. And in the interim, we will continue to take care of all our customers. And our, just in the very word that we have, right, the united, it's the complete opposite of divided. And we continue to do our best to create good relations between all the countries we serve.
Kind of a big question here, but what do you think the future of the airline industry is in the next coming decades?
Oh, boy, that is a big thought. I think back to the issue of sustainability, I think we absolutely need to, you know, communicate a lot of what we're doing already and a lot of the options presented. I think that is going to be a big measurable difference because I think you're going to see, you know, the planet react in a stronger way over time. So I think that's one that'll be important. I think all things digital, I think it's just going to be critical, just as the world evolves. And then in addition, the human touch, I think, is very important. I think all of us as humans, when we travel, we like to feel, right, good about the choice we made and the product. And so at United, we're making very big efforts and investments to make sure our people on every, you know, for every customer, every flight and every day, you know, you feel good about flying it. So I think that'll be continued focus for us.
All right, Oscar, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
That was Oscar Munoz, CEO of United Airlines, talking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty. You can listen back to this report, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, hashtag beautiful sunset, hashtag birds, hashtag everything. Is the obsession with Instagram ruining our experiences of the great outdoors and of nature itself? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following the world.
The federal trial of former Honolulu Police Chief Louis K. Aloha and his wife, the former deputy prosecutor, continues today. The two are accused of framing her uncle for the theft of their mailbox, but it's a case that involves so much more. Our partners at Civil Beat are covering each twist and turn of the proceedings, and joining us this morning is politics and opinion editor Chad Blair. Chad, thanks for joining us. And the case now moved into a different phase, the defense.
Yeah, that's right. Nick Gruby, of course, Bill is our point person on the trial. We've also had another reporter covering it as well. There's so much to cover, as you indicated in your lead. It's an enormous case. But at its core, there's allegations of conspiracy and obstruction. It's more than just stealing a mailbox. It was an effort, the allegation is, to frame Gerard Puana, the uncle of Catherine K. Aloha, and it centers on a dispute regarding money over their family, and that's a whole nother thing. But the latest is that yesterday, Monday, the prosecution wrapped up its case. Remember, they took a week off last week. And today, Nick's down at the courtroom because the defense is now presenting its case. There are five defendants, both K. Aloha's, three police officers, and today was expected to be Catherine K. Aloha's attorney, making her case. Some question as to whether Catherine K. Aloha might actually make an appearance on the stand. We'll wait and see how that turns out. But that's where we are. We seem to be moving fairly quickly on this.
And it's true. You know, you mentioned the prosecution rested in part of the defense case. As I understand now, at least sort of the betting seems to be that neither Louis K. Aloha nor his wife are going to be called as witnesses, is that right?
And they haven't thus far, but there is always that possibility. And Nick's story from yesterday, which really focused on one of the police officers that already pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge so that he could cooperate, that was Dustin Sellers. At the very end of his story, he did indicate that Catherine K. Aloha's attorney could very well call her client to the stand. But we'll see. As you know, you mentioned it's the running bet, but it's also wise counsel that maybe they should not take the stand in order to maybe not hurt their case. There was, in fact, an effort on the five defense attorneys to have the case dismissed. And Michael Seabright, the judge, said, absolutely not. There's plenty of evidence, a treasure trove. Those were the exact words that he used. The defense attorneys had argued, no, there's just really not enough evidence to take this case further. But in fact, Seabright feels otherwise.
You know, I mentioned that civilbeat.org covering a number of angles of this case, and Denby Fawcett had an interesting piece. It's on the site today. She writes in part about clothing selection, but of course, if you've been watching the Kealohas, the optics of this, it's an appearance that's sort of changed over time.
It has, and Denby, leave it to her to come up with this angle, to come up with something fresh, which, by the way, has helped tremendously by Corey Lum's photographs.
Ah,
yes. We have a whole bunch of photos. And if you look back to October 2017, when they were first arraigned, when the indictments came down, Louis Kealoha, mind you, the former police chief, wearing faded blue jeans, wearing a long sleeve Aloha shirt, vintage, sporting a ponytail. And then Catherine Kealoha wearing Aloha wear, a lei. They seemed to be the happy couple, and that was the appearance back then, almost as if to say, and this was the implication after Denby talked to a number of attorneys saying, you know, look, we're fine, we're innocent, there's not going to be a problem. Well, the ponytail's gone. Catherine Kealoha cut her hair. The Louis Kealoha is wearing a suit. They are still color coordinated. But the wear is very serious, as Denby put it. You want to wear clothing like you would wear to go to church or to a job interview. You want to indicate that, look, we take this seriously, and that is how the clients are being presented right now.
And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned the that timeline of that shows not only in the photos, but also in sort of the attitudes around this case for some. And Denby, as she writes about, sort of not only the coordination of outfits, but the, you know, holding hands, other public displays of affection, really just trying to get down to sort of swaying opinion. Something you know a lot about, write a lot about.
Yes, I do, being in a politics and opinion editor. Denby brings up body language, and there have been a number of photos where Catherine and Louis are holding hands, or he will put his arm around her. There are no cameras period in the courtroom, but there is a sketch artist, and we've seen some of that. But you do see the Kealohas coming in every day to court, and that's where the photographers are taking pictures. Why would Louis and Catherine Kealoha hold hands publicly or in court? Well, the suggestion is that they're showing solidarity, that they're showing that, in fact, look, we are innocent. This should not be going against us, this court case. Having said that, Denby did talk to one attorney and said, you know, to me, it looks pretty contrived to see them doing this. So we'll see whether it backfires. But the jury is the 12 people that the Kealohas and their attorneys are trying to persuade. And we'll see whether that weighs on them. And who knows what the jury's going to do. We're not there yet. But we'll see afterwards whether they will talk and perhaps express their views, whether they were persuaded by the Kealoha's demeanor.
And meanwhile, that does bring it back to sort of framing that bigger picture, in that the prosecution, as you said, took quite a while in terms of making its case with all deliberation. Now we're into the defense phase, which really perhaps is not seen as going quite as long.
No, there is indication that it could wrap up as early as this week. Of course, we're talking about the defense, not the entire trial.
Right.
How long the jury might take to deliberate is another matter. But it seems to be going faster than we expected, at least as of today. There is a new attorney, Earl Partington, working for Catherine Kealoha. That's another new development in the case.
New developments, twists and turns as they occur. We'll keep you on top of them. And civilbeat.org is the place to stay on top of that. Chad Blair, politics and opinion editor at Civil Beat. Chad, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime, Bill.
All right. You can read a lot more about the Kealoha trial at Civil Beat, as I said, from Nick Gruby's daily coverage, Denby Fawcett's take on outfit coordination, and more, all at civilbeat.org. It's summertime, and a lot of you are out and about, including spending some time in the garden for a number of you. One of our recent programs focused on garden pests, and a lot of you had ideas to share. We start with Laura from Makiki.
How about trying bringing some of the eel from the Big Island to cull the rose-ringed parakeets on Kauai and Oahu? There's a good movie called The Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill. Similar situation, but there in San Francisco, there are some hawks, and those hawks keep the population of the parrots under control. Mahalo.
Hi, this is Carla from Kona. There's a different philosophy about pests for organic farming. One of the things is diversity. There's plenty of solutions out there besides chemicals, and the disrespect that we kind of have collectively toward creatures that destroy our plants. There's a different way of looking at it. There's plant communication. So far as pigs go, you could put razor wire on the bottom of an ordinary fence and they will not enter your property. And as far as a lot of these pests killing trees, when I was a child, they whitewashed the trees with diatomaceous earth in peach orchards and orange orchards. And I've used it on citrus trees. I've used it on cacao trees and on chili peppers. And it gets rid of the pests. So there are a lot of organic solutions. And if you talk to organic farmers, you're going to get a whole different perspective on this. I think it would be great for the public to hear that as opposed to the chemical method. Thank you.
Hello. My name is Bob Zwicky. Thanks so much for the program you had. I'd like to bring awareness to a major problem here in Haiku, Maui. It's actually probably on the Big Island, too. And the name of the plant is Schefflera. Some people refer to it as the umbrella tree. It has red tassels when it blossoms at the top that spreads out on red tassels about 18 inches long, and then that's how the seeds spread with the birds. It's a major invasive species problem here. The plant is in the ficus family, so it has very destructive root system. I've contacted the invasive species people here on Maui. They don't seem to understand the problem. Aloha.
We appreciate the feedback. You can give us a call at our talkback line at 792-8217. If you prefer, you can send us an email, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter. Listening to the conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Time to check in with astronomer Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with this week's Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe surrounding our tiny planet. Also, what we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we are fortunate to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What are we looking at this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week's stargazers, look out for Mars, low in the western sky after sunset, and also look out for Jupiter, rising in the east just after 6 p.m. The moon this week is passing through its full phase.
Now, I understand you've got a discovery in our solar system that relates to something that many people use on a regular basis, and that is table salt?
It is. Astronomers have been hard at work using the Hubble Space Telescope to study the large icy moon of Jupiter, Europa. Now, it's been a long time since any spacecraft have explored the Jovian moon up close, so Hubble was employed to update some of the visible light data. This data revealed the presence of sodium chloride, which you and I know as good old table salt.
Hadn't we already discovered salt up there, or is this a different variety?
Yeah, we had, but the true nature and composition of the salt was unknown. This new data shows conclusively that the salt is not some exotic compound, but rather regular old table salt.
And is this something that kind of migrated up to the surface?
It is. Data from a wide variety of instruments on spacecraft and telescopes has given a pretty good idea of what's going on inside Europa, and we believe that this salt must have burst through to the surface between the cracks in the European ice. And this is a good sign that the icy moon is still very active on the inside.
And is this something that can be lucrative, like we can send a ship up there and just start loading the salt on board and bring it back?
It's a very long and expensive way to go for a little bit of salt.
Well, it would be kind of exotic salt. You could probably sell it for a pretty big markup. But more seriously, got to be good news for folks looking for life under the ice, right?
Absolutely it is. The presence of a considerable saltwater ocean under the ice, coupled with internal geological activity, means, of course, that our chances of finding life there are as good as any. In fact, it seems that with every new study of Europa, these odds go up.
So all we need is a discovery of some pepper, a little oregano.
Your cook-off collection.
For our barbecue on Europa. It's Christopher Phillips, and another fun and enlightening segment here on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer, and you can find it on demand at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name a prominent architect who made his mark during the reigns of King Kamehameha IV and V. A German-born carpenter by trade, he became a citizen of the Kingdom of Hawaii, and in addition to designing a number of prominent buildings and landmarks, he also became politically active in the kingdom. He served in the legislature as the secretary of the Board of Health and was ordained as a Knight of the Order of Kamehameha. He later served on the board of trustees of the hospital he built and designed, Queens Medical Center. Satisfied with his years of public service, he moved back to Hamburg, Germany in 1874, passed away shortly thereafter. His name was Theodor C. Huck. No winner on that today. Stumped the crowd. That is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. In the early 1970s, the United States was still mired in the Vietnam War. The Watergate story and investigations were underway, and Richard Nixon was on his way to re-election. But there was also some history being made in an area that's still developing today. It swelled into its own world, and that's growing around the world, including here in Hawaii. We're talking about esports, and HPR's Casey Harlow is here with more on that. Case.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Great. Well, esports, yeah, it started in 1972 when a group of Stanford University students competed in a game called Space War.
Space War.
And the prize was a year subscription to Rolling Stone magazine.
Nice.
Today, it's projected to be, actually, I believe it is expected to be a $1 billion industry. So you have people playing video games and winning millions of dollars if they come out in the top three places.
That's a serious change in development, and that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, one of the bigger tournaments that is being held in Seattle, it's called the Internacional. It's a Nintendo tournament, I believe. Actually, no, that's not correct. But it is the grand prize is $25 million for first, second, and third place teams.
$25 million. And where do the teams come from?
All over the world. You have teams from Russia, you have teams from Europe, America, South America, Asia. Asia being one of the biggest ones. South Korea actually has a huge esports community.
It's also, I know, in terms of business in Singapore, for some years this has been in terms of development and starting with sort of the gamers, as you know, in the tribal,
yes, exactly. Sorts. And the proliferation of the internet actually has kind of promoted this as well. So you don't even have to have everyone sitting in the same room. You can have teammates from if I was sitting here in Hawaii. I could have a teammate in California. I can have a teammate in Canada or anywhere else in the world. And so these teams are kind of brought together during these tournaments and have one common goal to beat the other team. And now you have this whole ecosystem surrounding it as well. You have even trainers to keep people, I get the players in top physical form. You have coaches.
All right, now wait a minute. I got to ask on the top physical form. You're not like you can't be doing like wind sprints for the. I mean, is this manual dexterity or what?
Apparently so. It's kind of to keep your mind sharp as well.
Ah, interesting.
And then you have like coaches that go over strategies, and you have psychologists as well. You have dietitians for some of these teams. It's kind of this whole thing. It's like an actual sports team, and there's a lot of debate of whether esports. Athletes are athletes if they consider themselves athletes. And the answer that I got from Sky Kavaloa up at UH, who is one of the few academics that are actually researching esports on the professional and the college levels, he says basically players just say, I guess we are athletes. I mean, every definition of what an athlete is, we go through that, but our competition is video games.
And this competition now, it's on, you mentioned collegiate study, but it's also on collegiate competition as well, and even reaching into here in Hawaii.
Yes. Well, not even collegiate, high schools.
Uh-huh.
Local high schools are also competing against each other. There was actually a championship series not too long ago against Iolani Red Raiders against the Roosevelt Rough Riders, and Roosevelt won. They are the high school champions. And I actually had a conversation with Senator Glenn Wakai yesterday discussing esports here in the islands and if the state is looking at possibly getting some sort of tournament here to kind of boost our economy or if they're looking at anything in that realm. And he says the OIA is actually seriously considering having esports teams because this subject could be just as big as football, basketball, volleyball in like 10 years' time.
You know, it's interesting. It's also even just as a story because you started off going down this road. And for our listeners, you know, different stories are different sometimes. And you start off with, well, this will be, you know, a couple of minutes. And then this grew and it grew to now a multi-part because you're coming back with more in terms of the local high school scene here.
Not necessarily the local high school scene here, but just as far as using tourism as a way to diversify our economy. Because these esports teams can bring millions of dollars, or these tournaments can bring millions of dollars into our economy as well. And we could even have possibly an ecosystem or even a... Yeah, we could have an ecosystem or we can become a destination for esports here. And since we are the link between Asia and the U.S., why not?
Lots of potential there. Esports, more than just fiddling around on the console.
Yeah, exactly. I just wish that I was a bit younger so I could rake in millions of dollars playing video games while I was growing up.
Well, you're in the perfect time space to be following this story for a little bit for us. Casey Harlow, you can find this story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Case.
Thanks.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. If you've ever had a child, you'll know that parenting advice can get pretty emotional.
Well, actually, if you do that, there's a very good chance your baby will die, and only someone who hates their baby would do that.
Wouldn't it be nice to bring some data into these conversations?
I really started digging into, like, okay, well, actually, what should we do here?
The Data-Driven Guide to Sane Parenting. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
this evening at 7, right after Counterspin.
That is the program for today. Up tomorrow, honoring the 100th anniversary of the birth of the First Lady of Limu, Dr. Isabella Abbott. We'll talk with one of her students, Celia Smith at the University of Hawaii, about Dr. Abbott's life and legacy. Tell us what's on your mind. You can call our talkback line and leave a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show, want a past one, you can find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics, all under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine Cruz back tomorrow. Please join her for more of The Conversation.